Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. My name is Paul Howard, and I'm the managing editor of Medical Progress Today, as well as the director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute. Our guest this afternoon is Luke Timmerman, an award-winning journalist at Xconomy, who specializes in the life sciences. Before joining Xconomy, Luke was the U.S. biotechnology reporter for Bloomberg News, based in San Francisco. There, he led coverage of major medical meetings and broke news about the industry's top companies. His stories have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, and the International Herald Tribune. Before working there, he also led passionate coverage of biotechnology issues and won many awards for his biotechnology coverage at the Seattle Times. Luke, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Paul. Pleasure to be here.
Luke, you had a fantastic column a couple of weeks ago, I guess just about a month ago now, called Big Data is BS in Healthcare, When Will It Become Real? And big data is one of these buzzwords that I hear all over the place these days, particularly about its potential to revolutionize healthcare, get the right treatment to the right patient at the right time. And this is important in health policy debates because we all know we've got a healthcare spending problem. The U.S. spends about, $2.8 trillion on healthcare, latest estimates. And there seems to be some consensus across the board, whether you're talking to payers or providers, that somewhere around 30% of all U.S. healthcare is wasted, or at least ineffective in terms of does it produce a clinical outcome that we actually want to happen. And your column talks about, I don't want to steal all your thunder, but talks about, how little progress we've made in actually utilizing data in healthcare and why that might be. And let me just quote your column for a moment here where you talk about the Wanamaker problem. The Wanamaker problem in healthcare is equally big and ripe for disruption. Cancer drugs typically only work for about 25% of patients who get them. Asthma drugs only work for about 60%. A lot of money gets wasted on treatments that don't work for an individual patient. Quote, and then let me just finish. We don't know what causes lots of diseases, rheumatoid arthritis included. We've certainly never had the ability to predict with a high degree of mathematical confidence which drug is most likely to work for a given patient. That is starting to change. So why don't you talk for a moment about where we're at in terms of big data in healthcare and why it hasn't come so far, and then perhaps what are some of the real opportunities and what it's going to mean for companies in the biotechnology and pharmaceutical sectors?
Well, I think right now you hear a lot about big data as a buzz phrase in other industries where it's really taking off, in things like our ability to predict the weather and traffic jams and stock movements. There's real progress happening in those fields. But in healthcare, it's always been more difficult because we have medical records that have been taken down on paper forever, and they're not easily funneled into electronic systems. And at hospitals, they often have many different proprietary software formats that don't talk to each other very well. So our ability to analyze data is pretty limited on things like patient characteristics and how certain patients might respond to certain drugs and what kind of outcome that they might have. I think that is beginning to change now as insurers in particular are financially motivated to take whatever they can get from electronic medical records to try to weed out, to discern some patterns, to help them reduce that waste, that Wanamaker problem that you mentioned. That's high in their minds. So they have begun to realize that there's a way to cobble some existing data together, whether it be from the existing electronic record systems that are out there. Some are better than others. Like Kaiser Permanente, say, on the West Coast, has pretty good systems. Others are catching up. They're trying to find out things like, there might be, say, 20,000 multiple sclerosis patients in our coverage network. Can we put together that data on their experience in real life and discern some real patterns patterns here. So an example might be there are five different drugs for MS out there now. They've all been tested in company-sponsored clinical trials, but never head-to-head. And we have kind of a our basis of medical evidence says that, you know, like you said from the column, maybe half or 60% of patients respond. But actually, if you look at patient experience, the payers are beginning to learn that we can get a much more nuanced idea. Maybe 70% of Asian Americans respond to a certain MS drug, whereas 50% of African Americans would respond to it. And so you might want to change your formulary to reflect that kind of patient experience within your network. Kind of thing that the pharmaceutical companies don't really know, because maybe they just didn't have enough patients from all the different demographics in their controlled clinical trials. So the payers are beginning to realize, hey, we have access to some data from real life experience. Never mind all this genomic stuff. That's coming later. but there are things that we know from our existing body of experience in how we treat patients that we can mine and we can use to better allocate our scarce healthcare resource.
And let me ask you about that data, because it's a fascinating point. So I guess a lot of that data, you would call it, I guess, observational data. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so.
So it's observational data. And, you know, the companies, I guess, would respond and tell me if this thing. They'd say, well, you know, that's observational data. We're concerned that you're not capturing, you know, pick your variable X, Y, or Z for that population. So and then I think the interesting question is, is that data going to be able to be used by companies to, let's say, promote the fact that, let's say, hypothetically, Asian Americans have a higher response rate for this particular MS drug? I think the FDA would be very uncomfortable and probably say, just that's illegal for you to do that. So that is data. I think you're presenting a picture of a world where the data is going to cut both ways. It can restrict utilization for inappropriate uses, potentially. Or it can expand utilization and potentially reimbursement for products in the populations where they appear to have very high efficacy. So how do you get some kind of agreement, I guess, on A, what counts as high-quality data, and then do you need to draw in the industry or the regulators to say, oh, okay, these are the circumstances under which that information is either going to be regulatorily relevant or that it can be disseminated by companies who might want to say, yes, that's right. Let me put that, you know, in my marketing materials.
It's a great question. I have a hard time imagining that the FDA is going to get out in front on this. They have, you know, a lot of history around their classic, you know, well-controlled clinical trial system. Requirements that they put on companies before they can start marketing a drug. They have very high standards for evidence. This kind of stuff really comes into play post-market, which is not really where the FDA puts a lot of its time and energy. So it's going to be more relevant to payers, at least in the beginning. But I think the FDA is going to have to catch up at some point, because the data will tell us things like it'll send us signals early about adverse events, say, that may not have been spotted in the company's controlled clinical trial. So what do you do with that? Is this the kind of thing that needs further examination, like, you know, a new advisory panel to weigh the risk and benefit that of a drug, say, that you know, we thought we understood based on a controlled clinical trial, but once it gets out into a broader population and real-world use, the data tells us something else.
I think that's a terrific point. And you could wind up with a situation where there's one set of efficacy data you need to clear the FDA, and then you're negotiating over a whole different set of data to try and get reimbursement from your payers, which I think, you know, given current clinical trial and development costs, would be a nightmare for industry. But is there a place here? There was a potential win-win-win. Let me put a hypothetical to you. You know, if the FDA, as it has been, you know, in Fidaja, which is the last PDUFA reauthorization, being pushed to, you know, move more indications into accelerated approval, not just for cancer and HIV. Is there a world where that post-marketing data might give the agency more comfort that it can approve drugs based on these surrogate markers, have them better monitored on the market through these electronic big data systems and accumulate better evidence? And it might be on safety, it might be on efficacy, it might be to expand the original label indication. That might give regulators more comfort that they've got the data that they want, and the payers get the data that they want. And on the other hand, the company knows that it's not just a one way street for them in terms of they're going to have to do their full, you know, phase 3 randomized clinical trial. They're going to have to eat those costs, and then, by the way, they're going to have to be subject to these other restrictions on reimbursement once they get out into the market.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think this could work out very well for FDA and the companies. If you're FDA, you're terrified right now about the possibility of another Vioxx situation, right? And you're afraid of the unknown because, gee, if we let some drug on the market based on a thin body of evidence from randomized trials, and then we discover later, like we discover after a lot of people get hurt, that it was dangerous, you know, it makes the agency look bad. It makes the company look bad. It's just people get hurt. It's bad all around. Now, if the FDA knows that, it sort of lowers the stakes for the FDA in a way. If we have good big data ability to capture this kind of data in real time, imagine if you could detect the a serious adverse event signal after just a couple of patients or a small handful, not like dozens or hundreds of people getting hurt. Suddenly, those things become much more manageable. The data might tell us, you know what, this drug shouldn't go to people with, say, a pre-existing cardiac condition. And so you contraindicate, you make it so the drug can't be taken by that subset of patients, but it can stay on the market for everybody else. I mean, that kind of situation, which is very good for the FDA. It enables them to, continue to protect the safety of the public. And it's very good for the company, too, because, instead of losing a drug and then having a public relations debacle on their hands, they suddenly have a slightly more targeted drug that still could be very successful for them.
Or you don't have to pull that drug from the market. Maybe there's enough decision support there to make the FDA and physicians comfortable they can prescribe the drug appropriately and learn a little bit more as they go. Let me ask one kind of final question. You know, there was a piece, it's been bouncing around quite a bit now. So in the journal Blood, a number of oncology physicians wrote actually about chronic drugs for chronic myelogenous leukemia, that cancer drug prices have gotten too high, $100,000 average cost for new drugs. Editorial in the New York Times, I think it was today or maybe it was yesterday, saying, go oncologist, complaining about the high cost of new medicines. It seems to me that this is another potential, application of this issue, we just spoke about a little bit, but in terms of getting total value out of the system, I think it's not going to be adequate any longer to just put out a product and say, here's the efficacy signal from phase 3 trials. Here you go. There's going to have to be ongoing, and I think everybody's going to demand it. It's going to be the payers. It's going to be regulators for the safety reasons that you just spoke about. And then we've got to find a way for it to be a win for innovation if you want to have, as we have had, better and better outcomes for some of these diseases. But the price tag for development is the largest component of the price of these high-profile therapies, even in cancer, where I think the success rate is even smaller than it is across the industry, something like 7% for all drugs that enter clinical trials. So is that another piece of the puzzle that we need to be thinking about in terms of big data, which is, if you want to get the price of the product more sustainable, you've got to think about ways to get it to market less expensively and less haphazardly than we've been doing for the last, you know, whatever it is, 50 years.
Well, no question. The high prices that you're seeing with cancer drugs in particular is a reflection of all the failures in the rest of those companies' pipeline. There's a huge amount of inefficiency in drug R&D, and so when they get a winner, they really feel the need to make up for all the other failures. So if you could, through big data, analytics, better targeting, stratification of patient populations in clinical trials, if you can, you know, just use this expanding body of knowledge about biology to your advantage and reduce the failure rate, increase the success rate, it takes a lot of the pressure off the companies to set these really high prices. And I think once a drug is on the market, there's potential for pretty significant market expansion early. So, for example, one of these targeted drugs that Roche came out with a year and a half ago called Zelboraf, it targets a mutation called BRAF, which, you know, they ran the controlled trials. It looks good for the BRAF mutant patients with melanoma. But a lot of enterprising oncologists have realized, well, gee, if this drug is targeted for BRAF mutations and I've got access to some other kind of molecular diagnostic that tells me different kinds of cancer overexpress BRAF, well, maybe I should try this drug on patients who, you know, otherwise I never would have thought of using it in before, like colorectal cancer that overexpresses BRAF, say. So suddenly the manufacturer has a drug that has a larger market opportunity. Because it wouldn't take, I don't think it has to hinge on the classic prospective randomized clinical trial. But if you've got, you know, a real-time, real-life observational set of data, as you say, that's accumulating, it could provide a pretty good rationale for prescribing that drug for that set of patients after maybe, I don't know, 50 patients. If 40 of the 50 patients who are BRAF overexpressors with colorectal cancer respond, I think the FDA and insurers would all say, they'll have to adjust some of their traditional ways of thinking about what is allowed and appropriate. But, I mean, it's going to be pretty hard to say, no, you've got to run a randomized prospective trial to prove that BRAF overexpressors in colorectal cancer will benefit. Like, the data will just accumulate in real time, and it will point us in that direction.
Right, and I think that's a terrific point to end on. That you're absolutely right. So the treatment effect, if you've got a, you know, visible, especially for some of these target drugs, it leaps off the data. I mean, you just look at the patient response, and you can say, wow, you know, that's just so far above the historical response rate. It's got to be the intervention. So maybe that is a point at which, you know, regulators are going to become more comfortable with that. And I think you're also right. Like, the oncologists, when they see that effect, they will really, you know, trumpet that and say, you know, we've got to have access to that drug. So maybe there it is, a real win-win-win for the innovative companies who bring products to market that are frankly targeted, that give, through a companion diagnostic or some other technology, an ability for the providers to actually find the patients who are the high responders, rather than just saying, you know, putting it on the market and say everybody who gets it is going to be charged $100,000.
Yeah, and I think the pharma companies are motivated now because they realize that this data is piling up, whether it's at hospitals or it's at payers or some other kind of third-party vendor. Other people are gaining more knowledge and understanding about how their products are working in real patients beyond the classic clinical trial. And they're realizing they need to catch up here and figure out how best their products should be used. So I think it's a time of exploration for the pharma companies. I think they are motivated to figure this out and hopefully bring some more efficiency to their model.
Well, I think it's a terrific point to wrap up. Big data in healthcare, particularly in the biotech pharmaceutical industry, not quite where it is in other industries yet, but probably going to be catching up soon because of the payment pressures that are now coming to bear on the healthcare sector. Luke, thanks very much for your time.
Great. Thanks, Paul.